Well, hey there, vinyl collectors. Do you know that AudiophileUSA.com has a ton of original jazz records? 7,383 to be exact. Many of them audiophile quality and ready to ship to you wherever you are. Over at AudiophileUSA.com, you'll find Blue Note, Music Matters Jazz, Analog Productions, and heaps of other titles, all in excellent and near mint shape. Some of them are even still sealed. So don't be slow. AudiophileUSA.com is a family-owned and operated vinyl record dealer, and with over 42,000 vinyl titles in stock, there's something for everyone at AudiophileUSA.com. Go to it. And when you get those records, you're going to need something to clean them with, which is where the Groove Washer record cleaner comes in. The Groove Washer is the best record cleaner on the market. I use it daily, and it keeps my records clean, my listening experience wonderful, and my collection in archival shape. Other record cleaners can leave a residue on your vinyl, which over time can make your records gummy and sticking to their sleeves. Don't risk devaluing your collection. Ask for the Groove Washer by name. And look, here's 10% off anything at groovewasher.com. Use checkout code VinylGuide10. Do it now, groovewasher.com, checkout code VinylGuide10. And with that, let's get into today's episode of The Vinyl Guide.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, hey everyone, it's Nate here. I hope you're well. I'm back here in the seat after a week off, and as you can probably tell, I have a bit of a cold. I've been tested for COVID. I'm negative, thank God. So I seem to be fine, but I just cannot shake this cough. Bit of a sore throat here. So hoping it'll be gone by the next episode, so wish me luck. Anyways, good to be back here in the hot seat. I've been home, like everyone else in the world probably, spinning records. I've been picking up some great vinyl on Bandcamp. I've got some new King Gizzard pressings that I've been enjoying, and I've even done some videos on. They're over on our YouTube channel if you want to check out some of those flightless pressings. But overall, I'm just trying to stay healthy and well, and I hope you all are doing the same. So today, we have a wonderful guest on The Vinyl Guide, Mr. Lou Donaldson, saxophone player on some of the greatest jazz recordings of all time. Mr. Donaldson is 93 years old, and I'm absolutely grateful he was able to speak with us and share some stories about working with Blue Note Records back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, his times with Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, Art Blakey, Clifford Brown. He's recorded with Rudy Van Gelder, which he speaks about today. He also clearly speaks his mind on his opinion of the free jazz movement. And overall, I had an absolutely delightful conversation with Mr. Donaldson. And I don't think I've laughed nearly as hard in an interview in quite some time. So great stories from a phenomenal musician, and we're very glad to have him on the show today. Now, what you're going to hear today is a big chunk of the interview I did with Mr. Donaldson, but I do have an extended version available for show patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. Mr. Donaldson shares even more stories about playing live in New York, going from downtown to uptown clubs, getting guests on stage to sing with the band, and some very fun and informative extras, which you can only listen to by being a patron of The Vinyl Guide at patreon.com/vinylguide. Go up there. You can hear the extended interviews of many different episodes, not just this one. I put up secret episodes. You get early access to interviews and heaps more. That's over at patreon.com/vinylguide. And by the way, if you enjoy our conversation with Mr. Lou Donaldson and you like jazz records, well, you are in luck. We have heaps of other episodes with the jazz community on The Vinyl Guide, including episode 224 with jazz legend Mr. Ron Carter, episode 173 with Michael Cascuna of Mosaic Records, lots of jazz vinyl talk on that one, episode 157 featuring Joe Harley, the architect of the Blue Note Records Tone Poet series. He's going to be sharing stories from the vaults of Blue Note. That's episode 157 of The Vinyl Guide. Don't miss that one. Episode 105 with the president of Blue Note Records himself, Mr. Don Was. Back to episode number 70, we spoke with Blue Note recording artist Larry Ridley. Lots of tales of early Blue Note and jazz history in there as well. And all of these episodes, plus tons more, are available anytime at thevinylguide.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Sonnet, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And with that, let's start today's interview with jazz legend himself, Mr. Lou Donaldson. This week on The Vinyl Guide, we are here with Blue Note musician and jazz legend, Mr. Lou Donaldson, and I'm so excited to be speaking with him. Mr. Donaldson, how are you feeling today?
Pretty good.
Good. Well, look, it's an honor to speak with you. I have many of your records. I've enjoyed your work for many years, and I'd love to talk to you about your records as well, the ones you made and the ones you love to play. Is that all right with you?
Yes, all right.
Excellent. Now, I understand when you were young, your mother was a music teacher, so you had a lot of music around the house. Did you have records in the house as a boy?
No. No records.
Okay. So your mom was a piano teacher. And how did you come to play the alto sax?
Well, the alto sax, I started with clarinet.
Mm-hmm. And the clarinet?
Because I didn't want to play piano because she was too hard on the students. Mm-hmm. She had a switch, and when they missed a note, she'd drop them across the hands. So I never played. And one day when I was about 9 years old, she told me, said, you have more musical talent than anybody in this family. You should be playing piano. I said, not me.
You didn't want that switch.
So she went and switched to and got a clarinet for me to play.
Now, as I understand it, your musical career really started taking off when you were in the service. Is that right?
Well, no, I went to college. I was in college band.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the marching band, playing clarinet.
Okay. And I believe your first appearance on record was on H-Bomb Ferguson and the Charlie Singleton Orchestra. Is that correct?
Probably so, yeah.
Okay. Do you remember much about that record? I Love My Baby.
Yeah. I remember everything about it. At that time, Charlie Singleton was making background records for all the singers.
Mm-hmm.
Ruth Brown, Little Annie, Winona Harris, a lot of people. And they brought this guy in, H-Bomb Ferguson, and we did this date with him.
And was that your first time in a recording studio?
No. I'd been in there before, making background records.
So you're...
Ferguson, that's the first one that I made where they put your names on it.
So you were on a lot more records before then, just as a background musician.
Background records.
Got it. And when you moved from North Carolina to New York, were you able to quickly make a comfortable living playing jazz?
Well, no. See, when I came to New York, I went to school.
Mm-hmm.
I was a GI a veteran, and I went to school on the GI Bill. Government paid for the training. And I went to the Darrow Institute of Music on 59th Street in Broadway.
Mm.
And I was studying there for about a year. But I was playing gigs on the side,
And you played with so many greats. Monk, Art Blakey. Did you also play with Charlie Parker in those early days?
I played with him. I played a couple of jam sessions with Charlie Parker.
Mm-hmm.
But I never worked, a regular job with Charlie Parker.
Mm. And I imagine he influenced your playing in the early days quite a bit.
Of course, when I was in the service, I was playing clarinet. And we got this record by Jimmy Sin, Jumping the Blues. And when I heard that alto, I got in the alto right away. I took my clarinet and put it away and started playing the alto. Except, you know, I had to play the clarinet sometime in the band, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But if I had a solo, I'd always take it with the alto.
Do you remember anything that Charlie Parker taught you back then, working with him?
Oh, no, he didn't teach me anything. You know? No, he didn't teach me anything. In fact, I had studied his records, you know, and when we played together, at one time I played some of his stuff, and he told me, he said, oh, that's some nice stuff you're playing. And I said, are you kidding me? I said, I got this off of one of your records. He acted like he didn't know it. He said, oh, yeah.
So how did you get discovered by the Blue Note guys?
Well, what happened? I was playing Monday nights at Minton's Playhouse. Mm-hmm. See, that's the night when the regular band is off, and I had the band. And Alpha Lion came by there one Monday night. And he was president of Blue Note.
Mm-hmm.
And he heard me playing. And he asked me, did I want to make a record? And naturally, I told him, yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. He said, but you got to play like Charlie Parker. Can you play like Charlie Parker? Well, hell, I couldn't play like Charlie Parker. I said, yeah, I can play like Charlie Parker. I said, yeah, I can play just like Charlie Parker.
Fake it till you make it.
Yeah, so that's what happened. You know, I pressed up on my Charlie Parker playing, and I made a day. But I made the day with Milt Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
First day I made on Blue Note was with Milt Jackson, 1952. Milt Jackson, John Lewis was on piano, Percy Heath on bass, and Kenny Clark on drums. See, that ended up being the Modern Jazz Quartet. But when I made the date, it was Milt Jackson's group.
Oh, that's right. Then you guys recorded Tahiti and What's New.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Don't get around much anymore.
Did you record more than those songs that day? Did you record?
Yeah, I made a whole day. I made a bag's groove.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I don't get around much anymore.
All right, so you recorded a lot of songs, and then they just issued them over time.
Well, it was Jackson's date, you know. It wasn't my date.
Right.
So if you want to find a date, it's Milt Jackson's date, and I'm on it.
Yeah. Well, you started making records very shortly thereafter with them. Raucous and Cheek to Cheek, I believe.
Yeah, Dancing Cheek to Cheek, yeah.
Yeah, so you became the band leader at that point.
Oh, yeah, Loon's Blues. I made Loon's Blues.
Yeah. And you had a very handsome man on piano, Mr. Horace Silver.
Horace Silver, right.
What was Horace Silver like? What was playing with him like?
He was great, you know. It was great. He was just in New York, too. He was a young fella. Portuguese, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I told him, I used to call him Portuguese piano player.
Now, at this time, did you ever go over to the Blue Note offices?
Yeah, I went by there two or three times a week.
Oh, okay. Were there records all over the place? Did they have a record player always playing music?
Oh, yeah. Well, they didn't play music, but they had records stacked in there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And every day I went by there, I would see Monk there. Monk was there every day. And Monk was a junkie, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Every day around 5 o'clock, they told me he came by there because that's when they closed the office and went to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed up there every day to go get some food and some money, you know, from them.
So Monk always hung out at the Blue Note offices, too. Was there a piano? Were there instruments in the Blue Note offices?
No instruments.
Okay.
Monkey used to come by there to get some money for his habit.
Okay. So there was no music playing. It was all money and food.
They had a record player, of course, yeah. But they didn't play as much music.
And this is on Lexington, I believe, at their address.
Yeah. 59th in Lexington.
When you made a record for Blue Note, did they give you a bunch of copies of it?
No. I got probably one copy.
One copy. Okay.
They didn't give me a lot of copies of it.
Okay. When you swung by the offices, they didn't say, "Oh, check out this artist," or "Here's an Art Blakey." They didn't give away many records.
Oh, if you ask them for it, they give them to you.
Okay.
If you knew what you wanted, you know, if you knew what you wanted.
Mm-hmm. When you were recording for Blue Note in the early days, they were still recording at WOR Studios. What was the environment at WOR like compared to Rudy Van Gelder's place?
Well, Rudy Van Gelder recorded in his house.
Mm-hmm.
He started out recording in his house, in one room in his house.
Mm-hmm.
And Rudy Van Gelder was an optician. He was an eye doctor, and he brought this new equipment from Germany, and it got a different sound in other places. So it was different, much different.
When you agreed to do an album for Blue Note, did you record more than was released, or did you record specifically what was on the record? Were there any leftovers?
It might have been some more takes. You know, sometimes we make a tape really light, so we make another tape. So probably with some leftovers and takes.
Do you remember working on any artwork, or was that all done and you were surprised when you saw the record?
Oh yeah, it was done by Frank Wolf. Frank Wolf, who was Alpha Lion's partner, he did all the choreography and stuff. I didn't have anything to do with it.
Okay.
Except the pictures that I took, you know. Mm-hmm. Put on an album cover.
Was Francis Wolfe always walking around with a camera, or did he only break it out here and there?
Yeah, he came around with a camera. That was his job, to make pictures.
And when a record came out, did you do any record promotion? Did you sell any of the records at shows or go to record shops at all?
No, I never did that. Sometimes we went to some of the disc jockey shows, and you would have an interview, and they play the record. But I never went around with records, you know, to sell.
And what was the deal for a musician or a band leader? Did Blue Note pay a flat rate, or did you get a royalty for each one sold?
Oh, we just got a flat rate.
Mm-hmm.
That rate back then, I think it was $125.
Okay, $125 for
it was a flat for the leader. Sad man, I don't know what they got.
It wasn't your problem.
Because Bruno was a cheap company, you know.
Yeah, but boy, he did some great stuff. Now, as I understand it, you brought in a lot of musicians, including Grant.
I brought in about 50 musicians.
Some of the names I heard were Grant Green, Blue Mitchell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lonnie Smith, wow. Donald Byrd, Clifford Brown, John Patton, George Benson. Well, I brought in a lot of musicians, you know.
Wow. And it probably wasn't too hard for you when you met a young musician that was good to say, "Hey, would you like to record a record for Blue Note?" That was very easy conversation, yeah?
Oh, yeah, very much.
Now,
everybody wanted to record for Blue Note.
Now, why did everyone want to record for Blue Note? What was exciting about Blue Note at the time?
Well, For one thing, and you didn't have to go through a lot of hassles with Alpha Lyra. Mm-hmm. You were like one of the guys, you know. Mm-hmm. Other record companies, you had to go through a lot of stuff, so people didn't want to bother around with them.
But they were very popular records amongst jazz musicians, so everyone recognized at the time Blue Note was the place to be.
Well, that was there. It was just a few people there, you know. Mm-hmm. Later on, everybody owned the record for Blue Note. But when I was there, it wasn't like there. Just a couple of people there.
One of the legendary recordings, and I was just enjoying it the other day, was the Art Blakey set at Birdland. Not only a great set of musicians, but Pee Wee Marquette as the MC. What do you remember about Pee Wee?
Well, Pee Wee was a midget. Mm-hmm. He was about 4 feet tall. Mm-hmm. And he tried to hustle the musicians, you know. If you didn't give him 50 cents, a dollar, he wouldn't pronounce your name right, you know. He might call you anything, you know. Mm-hmm. But if you paid him off, he'd pronounce your name right.
So you had to pay him off to pronounce your name right. Did he ever try?
Yeah, just to get your name pronounced. You had to pay him. He didn't pay him. He said, oh, hey, alto saxophone player.
You wouldn't even say your name. And that Birdland set had Clifford Brown on it as well. And Clifford Brown, you said you brought Clifford Brown to Blue Note and you played with him.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, his life ended early. What can you tell us about Clifford Brown?
Well, he was a genius, trumpet genius. And see, I had made a date with Clifford Brown about 3 months before the Birdland date. Mm-hmm. I made a date for Blue Note with Clifford Brown. Because Brown speaks, stuff like that. It's about 3 months before that. And Clifford was a very studious guy. He didn't act like a musician, you know. Because he came to work. Suit and tie. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a very serious guy, you know. Mathematician.
I always imagine a lot of the musicians would wear suit and ties to the gigs. Did they not dress up?
A lot of them didn't dress up. I always dressed up. I always had a suit and tie. Mm-hmm. A lot of them never dressed up. You know, it comes to the gig any kind of way.
I guess it depends on your band leader, what your band leader wants you to do.
Well, the band leader didn't care because Art Blakey, he didn't care.
Oh, he didn't? Okay. He always dressed so sharp. I figured he...
Well, he had a suit on most of the time.
Playing drums. Whew, that's hot.
Oh, yeah. He was a bad man on the drums.
Yeah. How was
but
he?
Actually, that date wasn't his band. You know, he said it, but it wasn't his band.
No?
No.
Whose band was it?
He just said that it was a Blue Note All-Star band. Blue Note All-Star band. Music and all that stuff. Horace and myself got it together. We were going to use Art Taylor on drums because Art was out of town in California. Oh. He had some trouble, and he didn't have enough money to get back to New York. So, but once he got back, we used him, you know.
Wow. See, you should have given Pee Wee Marquette a dollar. It would have been the Lou Donaldson All-Stars.
Yeah, you say that, didn't you?
The other musicians that you've played with, again, the list is endless. What was Thelonious Monk like as a friend and collaborator?
Well, Thelonious Monk was, he was selling out. He was a junkie, you know. Mm-hmm. He didn't have much to say. And he was hollering right out the parts for you to play. You had to memorize them from what he was playing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he was right about it, and sometimes he wouldn't. And you had to always have a conversation to make sure you were playing the right stuff. And I'd ask him all the time, is this right, Monk? He said, oh, yeah, you're all right.
And then contrast that to Art Blakey, who is very disciplined in his approach to the music.
Well, disciplined with his drums. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't disciplined with the band.
No?
No.
Okay.
No. When you had a rehearsal, he played so good, you know, you want to give him a kiss. But once he got on the bandstand and the crowd came, and the women came, you know, and sit in the front row and pull up their dresses over their knees, you heard nothing but drums. The drums got louder. Tempos got faster. And I took a solo on every song. So everything changed.
Now, the role of band leader in those days, it seemed to rotate around. Like, you'd play on Art Blakey's album, then he'd play on yours. Was the real difference who picked the music, or was there a bigger role for the band leader?
No, it's just a date, you know.
Okay.
Whoever the band leader was the date. Usually the band leader would pick the music.
Mm.
I picked all the music for my dates.
Did you tour a lot? How much?
Not at that time. Not at that time. I started touring in the 60s. Mm-hmm. In the 50s, I was around New York most of the time.
Now, you stuck with Blue Note for most of your career, and a lot of other musicians didn't stick with Blue Note. You were there during the times of different owners after Alfred and Francis sold the company, after United Artists got it. What was the difference? What were the changes that you saw in Blue Note?
The difference in Blue Note was that once they sold the company, wanted more commercial type music because they wanted to compete with the record companies. Mm-hmm. Which is when Alfred Lion had it, he didn't really try to compete with another record company. He just made what he liked, and that was it. But once you got sold, you had A&R men at the company, and they would want different kind of music. Something they could do on the jukebox, you know, or compete with the other types of music.
And so did they start making suggestions or even telling you what songs to play or how to play them?
Not really. But they would want something that they could use to sell, you know. Mm-hmm. They didn't really tell you what to play, except a couple of times, you know, they had George Butler. He was a A&R man. And he wanted, like, this day we're going to make for a big band. And this day we're going to make, seven or eight pieces instead of trio. Stuff like that. But he didn't really tell you the music, you know. Mm-hmm. You still had to get the music yourself.
You seem to avoid the free jazz movement, staying more with the, from hard bop to boogaloo and even soul and funk. What did you think of free jazz at the time? Why weren't you that involved in it?
Well, there's no such thing as free jazz. Mm-hmm. What they talk about is bullshit. That's the name of it, bullshit, not free jazz. Because the musicians that you talk about playing free, they couldn't play. They couldn't play the regular music, so they played a lot of junk.
Mm-hmm.
and see people, especially the people, the journalists, the magazine people. They were good journalists, but they didn't know anything about music. So anybody they saw that sounded weird, they figured he was playing some new music. He didn't realize he sounded that way because he couldn't play the old music. That's when they both catch around like Ornette Coleman. You know, Ornette couldn't play anything. He had nothing. He didn't know what end of the saxophone to put in his mouth. He was a joke. But see, they wanted to make that new music, which was ridiculous. And it drove all the people, like most of the people, drove the people away from the music, except for the eccentric. Eccentric white folks, they liked it. But you couldn't play that around black people anyway. They wouldn't play him, or they'd throw him out, or get fined after one song, he was fined. But see, they don't tell you that. They don't tell you that in the news.
I guess what's fascinating to me is how people like Coltrane started trying on this new style. It wasn't just Ornette Coleman. I mean, a lot of other musicians tried that as well.
Well, no, Coltrane was much later. It came much later.
Mm-hmm.
Coltrane had been playing straight ahead when he got to dealing with, you know, some kind of drugs, and you know, he ended up being a junkie too. So That's what you call junkie music.
But he cleaned up before he got into free jazz, so I'm not sure he could blame the drugs at that point.
No, he didn't clean up. He messed up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he messed up. He was ridiculous because The last part of his career, he wasn't playing them but a bunch of junk, you know. The disc jockey would throw that in the trash basket.
Now, your records seem to be more accessible in the Blue Note catalog. You had a lot of hits on Blue Note, perhaps.
Oh, yeah, I had several hits, but what I did, I went back and started playing swing music.
Mm-hmm.
They called it funk, but I wasn't playing funk. I was playing swing music, but they didn't know. The critics, they didn't know what it was, you know, so they called it funk, but it wasn't funk. It was swing music. Because funk was James Brown and stuff like that. I wasn't playing nothing like that. I just started to play in swing music again, and they thought it was funk, but it wasn't.
And you had a lot of hits. A lot of your records were jukebox favorites.
Right. Some of them still on the jukebox. Some of them still on the jukebox.
Well, they're certainly
all. I went to Cincinnati a couple of years ago, and a guy took me to a barber shop. It had a jukebox, a Nickelodeon.
Mm-hmm.
You had to put a nickel in it, you know, and it still had my records on that Blues Walk. Masquerade is over. Yeah, Alligator Boo Boo, all that stuff is still on the jukebox. It's almost 70-something years ago.
Well, that's great. Well, your records are certainly on heavy rotation in our house as well. And Mr. Donaldson, thank you very much for spending time with us and talking about records. Do you still have your old records, copies of your recordings?
No, I don't have one record. You know, people have come by over a period of years, and you know, even they get the records and they take them, and I don't notice it. They take them and take them away.
Oh my gosh! Let me ask.
When I want to get a record, I have to call the company and get a copy.
So those records that you recorded for Blue Note, do you know how expensive those original records are right now?
Oh yeah. It's easy for me to tell. Like, look at my Roth statement.
Yeah.
I know some places in Japan. I was over there once, and I've been over there a lot of times, but one time I was over there, and a guy took me to this store.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw, what was it? Something I had made. south of the border, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was selling for $140.
Oh.
The vinyl record, the 78.
So let me tell you, that's on the low end of the scale. There are copies of Lou Donaldson Quartet, Quintet, Sextet, Blues Walk, Lou Takes Off, that are close to $1,000 for one copy.
Oh, I can't believe that.
You better go get those records you loaned out.
Yeah, I can't believe that.
I bought an original copy of Blues Walk for $200, and I was elated to pay so little.
That's a great record.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great album. It's got a lot of good tunes on that one record.
Absolutely. That's where I would recommend people start, but there's so many other good albums. Good Gracious, Sunny Side
yeah.
Up.
Good Gracious is what I'm looking at this woman behind.
Mm, that's right.
She was my wife's hairdresser.
Okay.
Every time I take my wife to the beauty shop, I say, oh, this is a beautiful woman. Let her fix your hair.
You're a brave man for not using your wife on the cover.
Well, what happened is I told Bruno about it. And I asked her, did she want to make a cover picture? She said, yeah. So that's how we got her.
And who is the woman on the cover of The Natural Soul?
I'll have to see it. I can't really know that.
Oh, okay. Doris?
It was probably somebody. Somebody I probably didn't know. But this woman I knew. Most of those pictures, I didn't know the women.
Do you have a favorite album or music of yours that you enjoy?
No, I don't have any favorites. Mm-hmm. Best one I made though was Blues Walk. And the most popular one was Alligator Boogaloo.
Mm.
You know what I made most money.
Yep. Alligator Boogaloo in 67.
Yeah, Midnight Creeper, stuff like that.
I love that period. That period of, it's not just yourself, but Grant Green and the guys that were around Blue Note around that time, the music seemed to be very, again, very soulful. As you said, swing, a little bit of funk in it. I really like that era.
Yeah, I had good rhythm section, man. It leaves Mohammed.
Mm-hmm.
Great drummer. And I had a good organ player, Charles Irvin, Lonnie Smith, John Patton. Oh. Had some good guys playing. Melvin Sparks on guitar.
And Blue Mitchell.
And Blue Mitchell, of course. I called him Black Mitchell. You know, everybody called him Blue. I called him Black Mitchell. he liked that.
Yeah, and you discovered George Benson. We have Lou Donaldson to thank for George Benson. Where did you find George Benson?
Well, what happened, you wouldn't believe, John Hammond, who was over at Columbia Records, he was supposed to be this big expert, you know, on finding musicians. Now, he disbanded the Columbia jazz records about 57 or 58. He disbanded the company. And you know who he let go?
Who?
Everybody he let go. The next record they made, it was a million seller. He let Eddie Harris go. He let George Benson go. And he let Aretha Franklin go.
Oh.
Would you believe that? The next record, either one of them made was a million seller.
People are begging him to get fired.
he owned the company. You know, he was Billy Goodman was his brother-in-law.
Oh,
Billy Goodman married John Hammond's sister. So John Hammond was the big man. But just to show you, he didn't know what he was doing. He let those three artists go. All of them got millions of songs.
Tell us about the early days. The Harlem clubs would stay open till 4 a.m. You'd have to be at Rudy Van Gelder's in New Jersey for 9 a.m. recording. Is that right?
Sometimes we could be in the afternoon.
Uh-huh.
You didn't exactly have to be in at 9. Once he got his studio set up, we did most of our recordings in the afternoon. But when he had his house. You have to get over there by 9 o'clock.
And what was it like at Rudy Van Gelder's house?
Well, it was like a room. You go in there and make a record.
Mm-hmm.
You have his equipment, the speakers and everything set up, and you go right in that room and you do the recordings. Yeah. And he had a 6-hour limit, so you had to do the whole day in 6 hours.
Oh, okay. That was pack in and pack out in 6 hours.
That's right. So it wasn't a whole lot of, going back and forth. You had to get it done in 6 hours.
Do you remember if he had a record cutting machine? Like, as a band leader, would you leave with an acetate of what you recorded?
No, but I could have if I wanted to. I wanted, I could have, but I didn't.
Mr. Donaldson, again, thank you so much for joining us here on The Vinyl Guide. And I really do want to say a huge thanks for your musical contributions. I've enjoyed your records for many years. I know many of our listeners do as well and continue to do so. And I understand at this point you are 93 years old and still going strong. So I want to wish you the best of health and well-being for the next 93 years.
Yeah, well, I'd like to thank all of the people who bought my records. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And you can buy the reruns too and make that money again.
Do you, if we buy your current pressings, do you still see a piece of that?
Yeah, I still get it. When they re-release it.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people sit up on my records. I had a lot of gifts out. And people like that just sample my records.
Yeah.
And I made a lot of money from them sampling my records. Because they like the beat I had on my record.
Which records sampled Lou Donaldson and helped fund your retirement? Which artists?
Oh, well, Madonna did one.
Mm.
And Mary Jo Blige, big singer. Oh, I had a lot of people sample my records. I'm in good shape.
Wow.
But I always tell people, but you don't have to put this on the, you don't have to put this in the interview, but I tell everybody, I'm 93, I can't pee, and I can't see. And war is me.
Oh.
So have a good day.
You too, Mr. Donaldson. You take care of yourself. All right.
All right.
Take care. Cheers. There we go. It's an absolute honor to speak with Mr. Lou Donaldson. Jazz legend. Absolutely. By the way, there's more where that came from. If you want to hear more of this interview, head up to patreon.com/vinylguide. Join our community and you'll get the extended interview I had with Mr. Lou Donaldson. Lots more tales and laughs up there. Also, if you want to check out some Lou Donaldson on vinyl, there was a recent release on the Blue Note Tone Poet series of Mr. Shingaling. Find that wherever you buy your records. Lou Donaldson, Mr. Shingaling, the Tone Poet series from Blue Note Records. It sounds beautiful, and it's a fantastic record. Again, thank you very much, Mr. Donaldson. Ooh, I'm getting some thunder. You hear that? Nice. And
that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Make sure you tell your friends about The Vinyl Guide podcast. Share this on social media, on your Facebook, or tweet it out on Twitter. And if you have a few moments, please leave us a positive review on iTunes or Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. Log in and give us a 5 out of 5 or a 10 out of 10 and say something nice. That would be absolutely brilliant. We'll be back shortly with the brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.